The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the show for December 13th, 2012, and it's about value.
So, Chris, what's your value?
What's my value? What kind of value do you mean? What are you asking of me, Jeff? Are you implying I'm worthless?
Well, that's not at all. It's up to you. It's really important what you think you're worth.
Yes.
But I mean But the term value can mean a lot of things. Sometimes it can mean what your belief system is.
That's true.
Things you personally find of importance.
My mind always goes to money.
Well, sure. So there's value in the utility of something. You have of a device and you like how it does things for you.
See,
and that's a value to
no,
you.
No, not even that kind of money. I'm a cheapskate, so I think value. I think getting getting a good price, good value.
Right. So it's a good deal. You've found a good savings and struck quickly while the iron was hot.
Exactly. Yes.
Made the deal.
Bought on Amazon.
Well, that's good. And one of the things that I think that a lot of engineers miss out on, because we never really talk about it in school or otherwise, is what our value is in the workplace, what we bring to our employer.
Right.
Certainly, we have some economic value because they hire us and they pay us.
They don't do it for charity. They do it because they expect something of us, and there is some kind of trade of money for services.
And there are, in engineering education, there are a lot of people working hard to improve the way that we learn academic issues. There's currently a effort out there. There's one that I've enjoyed reading called the Big Beacon Manifesto, which is kind of saying how engineering education should change. And there's a professor from the University of Illinois, David Goldberg, and one from Olin College, Mark Somerville, mm-hmm. that talk about, they have a manifesto of, I don't know, it's like 30, 40, 50 items that they think people should be, the manner in which they think education should be changing. So, yeah. They've got one here. I'm just going to pick one out. The whole new engine, number 9, is the whole new engineer is a team player, a collaborator, and a community builder.
I like that.
Yeah, it sounds good. But my question is, that is what they think engineering should be, what they hope for it to be, and not what it currently is.
Well, so what does that mean for what we're talking about today?
Well, so what it means is there are relatively few researchers going out and investigating not what engineers should be doing, but what they actually are doing.
Ah.
And what value they bring to the workplace, as opposed to an abstract theory about what it should be.
If only we had this person to talk to.
Well, amazingly, we do have it. We have Professor James Trevelyan, who is a professor of mechatronics at the University of Western Australia. And we're going to talk with him this afternoon, or in this episode, about the economic value of engineering. How are you doing, James?
I'm fine. Thank you very much, Chris and Jeff. It's a wonderful day here in Perth.
Perth, Australia. Of course. Western Australia.
Perth, bottom left-hand corner.
That's right.
Of Western Australia, yes.
And how large is University of Western Australia?
We have about 25,000 students. It's, I guess, in American terms, it's a medium-sized university. It's a wonderful campus. If you ever want to travel this far, it's probably one of the best campuses to work on in the world.
That's great.
We're set beside a beautiful river. You just wander across the road, have a bite to eat, looking at the swans or even dolphins from time to time.
Wow.
That is nice.
Yeah, not a lot of that in Cleveland, Ohio, nor Indianapolis.
And James, what's your engineering background? How is it you came to be a professor of mechatronics?
Yeah, that's a good question. For a long time, I was developing robots for shearing sheep, long before the term mechatronics was coined. Mm-hmm. And in fact, right at the beginning, we didn't even call it a robot because in the mid-1970s, people associated robots with unemployment, or at least the threat of unemployment. It was only later that we were finally persuaded to call it a robot. We said, no, it's not reprogrammable. You can't use it for anything else other than shearing sheep.
Right.
But never mind. And then, of course, this term mechatronics came along, and it was quite a catchy term. And it really brought together the joins between mechanical engineering, electronics, electrical engineering, software engineering, where so many engineering projects have difficulties. You know, so many engineers have told me, well, how do we get around this problem? We've got software engineers blaming mechanical engineers for things that don't work, and the mechanical engineers blame the electronics. And I said, well, you wouldn't need to hire a mechatronics engineer.
And everyone can yell at that person then, right?
Yes.
Right.
But they have enough mechatronics engineers have enough understanding of the way the disciplines work together to fix these kinds of problems.
That's great.
And did you come to this from the mechanical or electrical side of the engineering discipline?
I came from mechanical engineering.
Oh, okay.
But I had a unique experience. I went to work for an aerospace firm developing avionics, you know, military and civilian aircraft electronic systems. And I was the only mechanical engineer.
Wow.
So when it came to mechanical issues, my word was taken absolutely. And when it came to electronics, I just pleaded ignorance. and, of course, I learned a lot of electronics in the process. So, yeah, I've done work across all the engineering disciplines, I guess.
Right.
Now, except perhaps fire engineering and petroleum, I'd have to say, no, I haven't done anything there.
Unless the robot needed an extra oomph that day, right? Or you got particularly angry at a robot and lit it on fire.
No, we did on a number of occasions, yes. a lot of people talk about artificial intelligence and how it might revolutionize robotics and so on and so forth. But as one experienced in working with robots over a long period of time, the last thing you want is a robot with a mind of its own.
So one of the things that we want to talk about here today is the as I mentioned earlier, is what engineers actually do in practice and the economic value they bring to their employers. And you seem to be one of the few researchers that are actually studying what engineers do in day-to-day practice as opposed to a theoretical idea of what they perhaps should do. How did you come to study that?
Well, it was in the process of getting gray hair and frustration, employing engineers in Pakistan
okay.
to develop better techniques for clearing landmines. You would remember a lot of landmines in places like Afghanistan, not very far away.
Mm-hmm.
And I started realizing that these engineers didn't have the kind of practical skills that I just took for granted when I'd been employing engineers in Australia. But I couldn't put my finger on it. I couldn't figure out what those practical skills actually were. I just eventually got to realize that they weren't actually singling me out for punishment.
Right.
That it was this was an issue affecting engineers right across Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and so many other developing countries. You know, as one Pakistan politician put it to me, he said, "A miracle is an engineer who can deliver anything at all." And so politicians have a very low view of engineers in that part of the world. So realizing that there was something systematic here, I thought, well, it wouldn't be too difficult to apply some techniques that I'd learned, social science research methods, in fact, I'd learned for the landmines research in figuring out what D-miners actually do, and apply that and figure out what these engineers were doing and go back to Australia and compare it with the mass of data that would exist on what engineers do around the rest of the world. Well, after many years of searching, finally it dawned on us that really there were so few observation records that you could rely on. And it begged the question, why?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I still don't know the answer to that. But yes, you're right. Very few people have stopped to ask, what do engineers really do? In fact, we had a meeting in Madrid last year. We got pretty much everyone we could around one table. I think there were 8 of us.
Right.
So, yes, it's a very small area of study, but I think one of great significance, because I think in future people will realize just how important this area of study is and what the potential benefits are.
It almost sounds like a mismatch of skills normally. Like you said that you had the experience with the social background, but many people who are interested in engineering are often, you know, practicing engineering, and they don't have the background of the social skills, the social sciences or the anthropology type background to actually know how to then approach the problem. And I always think about that with like CAD programs. People that design CAD programs are software people. And unfortunately, unless they have, you know, a working knowledge of how an electronics designer is using PCB CAD or a mechanical designer is using a, you know, a 3D CAD, then, you know, they're just coding, and you have to rely on other people and third party inputs, and there's not necessarily like the tribal knowledge so much as the, you know, like there has to be a very strict process to try and get what people really want into that software then.
Well, I think that what we're facing is a situation where engineering, as it is studied and espoused in university settings, has diverged so far from practice that we really do face a critical juncture in our civilization. You know, if you look at medical schools, all the teaching after about the third year of introductory science and so on, all the teaching is done by people who practice medicine. And yet, in engineering schools, it's rare to find anybody with substantial practice experience. And that's partly because engineers work on things which are, you know, big, expensive, hazardous, and quite often secret. Right. You know, the sponsors don't want their work being done right out in the public view in case other engineers come along and copy it. So it is hard to bring engineering practice into the academy, but particularly in the last 20 or 30 years, what we've seen is that universities have started to shuffle themselves into a ranking order which is determined by research. And so if you're a practicing engineer and you haven't published research papers in leading journals, you're not even going to get a job in a university. And that's become the norm around most of the world, surprisingly. You know, practical experience just isn't valued. Now, there's nothing new about that. In fact, philosophers have noted how knowledge of practice, the tacit knowledge, that implicit stuff that so many people carry around with them, has been relegated by philosophers to secondary status. Knowledge that you can write down in the form of propositions, provable or otherwise, has ascendancy in the academy and has had ascendancy for thousands of years. And I think this is part of the issue that we're facing here. So the result is that engineering practice knowledge has more or less vanished from the academy. Now, that's been true for quite some time. You know, engineers up until about 1900, 1920 or so, many of them were educated on the job.
Right.
And they learned their craft working alongside much more senior engineers. It was only later that we started to put engineers in classes. And until the 1950s, most of those classes were practice-based, taught by practicing professionals. Then, of course, people noticed that a major conflict that took place across the world had been won largely on the basis of scientific and technical capability. So science came into the ascendancy. And, of course, to study science, one needs very substantial background in mathematics. And so engineering courses became science-based, and the practice side departed. Now, for a while, this didn't really matter because the practice side was picked up when graduates came into the workforce. So here in Australia, we had many government-owned organizations, like in many countries, public works department, utilities, railways, defense. And that's where engineering graduates became good practicing engineers. And the best of them were then employed by private companies. In the States, your larger companies had magnificent training programs. And of course, for many of them, engineering was a lifetime career. You went into Westinghouse, you were trained as a Westinghouse engineer, you retired as a Westinghouse engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And so companies were willing to invest in very substantial development of knowledge and skills in the workplace. But now all that is vanishing. And it's vanished largely because the knowledge of what that that they were learning has itself almost vanished. And this is the critical juncture that we face. You know, when engineers face real situations, if you think about it and ask yourself, what are the factors that shape the contours of feasibility or even the boundaries of possibility? Mm-hmm. Yes, sure, engineering science is part of it. You know, the law of gravity applies. Thermodynamics tells you that you can only get so much useful work out of a heat engine. But in addition to that, there's issues like schedule. How fast is it needed? Who are your available suppliers? What's the distribution of knowledge amongst the people that you have at your disposal? What kind of precedents can you work from? What's the risk profile of the investors? You know, are you building a mine in Central Africa where they want to make a profit in the first 12 months and they don't care what happens after that? Or are you developing a piece of urban infrastructure which has to work for the next 100 years? And then what are the social influences around you? Because engineering takes place in a social context and is not immune from the kinds of pressures and the influences in the society around. And then above all, you know, who's providing the finance? What are their requirements and needs? So all these factors shape what engineers can do. But then ask yourself, how many of those did you learn about in school?
Virtually none.
So that's what we find, is that engineers spend an awful lot of their time being concerned about these other issues, and they're literally learning on the job. And because of that, much of the good stuff which was taught in large companies in countries like the States or in public utilities in many other countries, much of that has been lost. And I've come across in my interviews engineers who are literally searching for documents that go back 20, 30 years, and someone says, well, it used to be on so-and-so's computer. What happened to that? Where do you think it might be? You know, who's got the records of that right. contract? Because maybe there might be a piece of paper that would tell us how to do this.
Right. And
I've literally seen this knowledge. Yes, I've seen this knowledge literally disappearing in front of our eyes.
I've heard them talk about having wondering whether they could rebuild the Saturn V rocket, which the U.S. built in the 60s. And even though they have a number of the prints, they're unsure that they could actually do it today because so many of the companies, the small engineering firms and machine shops that made the pieces and knew the tricks of how you made each component work properly, they're gone. And that knowledge has disappeared, and they're not sure they could recreate it in a economically feasible
amount of time. You've put your finger on it. You know, one of the things that you notice is that when you talk about prints, you're referring to drawings and documents. Mm-hmm. As engineers, we prepare drawings and documents of the finished items. We very rarely put down everything that's needed to know how to get there. And, you know, if you go back thousands of years, archaeologists have been struggling to find any record of how engineers constructed the pyramids in ancient Egypt. Well, I suspect those engineers were no different to today's engineers. They were too busy getting onto the next job to worry about how they did it. And besides which, it was so obvious to them, there was no need to write it down. It would have been just, why would you bother to write down something like that?
Right. I can build another one in a couple hours.
Exactly. So a lot of our research has been reconstructing this practical knowledge in some kind of sensible framework so that it can be passed on.
What about the assertion, you know, I made these arguments to people in academia before, and they often say, well, we can't have practical experience because it's too narrow, it's too specific to, you know, a certain sector or job type. In the case of electrical engineering, you know, I say, well, why don't you teach PCB layout? And they say, well, not everyone's going to need to know PCB layout because some people will go on to be, you know, work on digital signal processing and, you know, programming DSPs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, look, you're quite right. And, you know, first of all, there's what I call a zero-sum game when it comes to curriculum. You know, whatever you want to put into the curriculum, something else has to fall out. Well, I think with respect to those people who hold on to that view, it's a narrow view of what curriculum is all about. If we look at the actual process, what's going on while students are engaged in their formal studies, they're actually doing heaps of interesting things which could actually carry over into practice if only you drew their attention to it. So I know that most of my students don't read the handouts I provide, even the really important bits. Instead, what they do is they figure out pretty quickly who is in that minority of class members who would have read the handouts, and they go and say, Leanne, can you tell me what we're supposed to be doing here? Now, that's exactly what we find engineers doing. But students don't like to own up that they do that.
Right.
They just quietly do it without thinking that this is something that you're not supposed to be doing. Whereas, in fact, if we drew their attention to it properly, we'd say, well, that's how you're supposed to function as an engineer. You're not supposed to know everything. What you're supposed to know is who does know and get them to help you and put together a team of people who complement each other's knowledge and skills and work out how to make that team work really effectively. So some of the things that our students are already doing are the kinds of things that they need in practice. The difficulty is that we regard them as being, if you like, semi-legitimate or even cheating. And so the idea that students should collaborate on something is definitely regarded as being cheating by many academics. And right. Even the students themselves think it's cheating. So, you know, you get a culture where everything is focused towards individual achievement. Mm. And if I suggest to a student that their grade is going to be affected by what another student manages to do with the results of their work, they get really upset.
Right.
They say, look, my grade is supposed to reflect my ability, and my grade should not be affected because some idiot has to work with the results of whatever I write down. And I say, well, welcome to the real world, brother.
Yeah.
See what happens when you start working as an engineer.
Yeah.
So we face this that's what I mean by the separation between practice and reality, that the academy has drifted so far from the reality of practice, largely because – you know, nobody thought to ask that question. What do engineers really do? So what we're doing at the moment is trying to set up this practice knowledge in an academic framework so that you can reduce it to its essentials. And so it's possible to introduce these ideas in parallel with teaching of engineering science. And the result is we get much better learning of engineering science, and we'd set up the foundations for practice at the same time. You know, one of the things a lot of engineers struggle with is how to get predictable results and how to get results which are error-free. Well, right. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we as students could hand in assignments and get 100% every time? And wouldn't it be a pleasure to mark those assignments for us academics?
Right.
But do we teach our students how to get rid of errors in their work, how to make sure there are no errors? No, we don't. We don't even stop to think about it. And at an even more basic level, we rely to an amazing extent on students' ability to listen. Yet there are no recognized tests for students' listening abilities in higher education. There are no tests,
right.
Other than tests which we give students who are doing English as a second language, but that doesn't test their ability to understand technical terminology, to pick out the key concepts, to make sense of what people are talking about. So when I've attempted to measure the listening skills of my students, it typically ranges between about 5% and 50% at the very best.
Wow. So, you know, both these things you brought up were, it seems like at least in those two cases, were grade dependent. Do you have specific feelings on, you know, the elimination of grades? I know that some schools try that kind of thing, but is that something that you actually promote, or what would you see change?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that many of my colleagues get extremely apprehensive when I start opening my mouth and talking about these ideas. Look, it's very important to recognize that where we are today depends on the expertise that we have nurtured and developed in universities over the last century. We can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have to respect that knowledge and say that it is extremely valuable. We have to treat it with great respect. And so it's very important to realize that we can't dispense with the technical knowledge. Students in engineering still have to learn mathematics because they use mathematical ideas all the time without necessarily realizing it. And there's been some great studies done to show how mathematics is actually used in the workplace. It's used in much more of a tacit, intuitive sort of way. But you can't get there without studying the foundations of mathematics in the first place. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very careful in thinking about education changes. So I see the real emphasis for the time being on postgraduate education. You know, when students get out into the workforce and they realize that there's all these other factors that influence what they can and can't do, that's when their minds are opened. If you try and teach engineering students and say, well, communication skills are really important. They just yawn, go to sleep, say, well, this is not engineering. And if you talk about the importance of relationships and trust, they'll say, that's all psychology. That's fuzzy stuff. Nothing to do with engineering. There's no point in trying to deal with people in that space. They're not ready to learn.
Do they simply not believe until they've been out into the workplace and experienced it for themselves?
That's correct. You know, so many young engineers in their first year have talked to me about feeling completely incompetent. And many of their employers regard them as being completely incompetent. You know, what a tragedy that is. But they very quickly realize that there's big gaps in their education. That's the moment to strike, when they're ready to learn, when they realize that, yes, I've still got an awful lot to learn, and there are things that I never dreamed that I would have to learn. You know, most of the people who go through engineering are really bright young people. They're really capable of learning what they know they need once they know they need it.
Well, I was going to say, there was a study out of MIT that was done a few years ago where they interviewed their alumni out of the mechanical engineering department and surveyed them as to what kind of skills they needed. And it was similar to the kind of things you've been describing, in that, you know, there was 10, 15, 20% of their work were the issues they had learned about in school, and everything else was communications and project management and finance and things that they had to learn on the job.
Yeah, you're right. And we've done a similar, much more extensive study. We've actually followed our own graduates for 3 years to find out exactly what they do every few months or so. Mm-hmm. And that produced some really interesting data. One of the most astonishing things is around this idea of communication and interacting with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, many people I've spoken to in engineering have this idea that young engineers start in mainly technical roles. They're sitting at computers doing calculations. And then later on, they'll progress to more management responsibilities. So one young engineer said to me, you know, I realize my communication skills are lousy, but when I become a manager, that's when I'll need to improve them. Now, what this study showed, and this was a real surprise for all of us, was that the amount of time that young engineers spend interacting with other people is exactly the same as it is for senior engineers. There is no difference from the first few months to the last 10 years, as far as we can tell. About 60% of the time is spent direct interactions with other people. Now, about half of those interactions are in writing, emails, reports, reading, writing, dealing with databases where you're putting in human-readable information. Project management systems are a good example of that. Mm. The other half of the time is generally voice and face-to-face communication, whether it be on-site, across a meeting table, on the telephone, or just casual social interactions in the office, looking at a computer screen, something like that.
Water cooler talk.
So,
kind of thing.
Well, the real issue was, well, what's going on here? You know, why is it so predictably around 60%? Some colleagues who joined us in this effort did a study in Spain and Portugal, and we had a figure around 60%. They came up with 61%. There have been several other studies over the years that we've located with exactly the same number, you know. And it's a bit like, I don't want to be pretentious, but, you know, Einstein made his breakthrough by observing that everybody got the same number when they measured the speed of light.
Right.
And he said, well, maybe the speed of light is constant. So that's the approach I took. I said, why is it that there is so much social interaction when engineers do their work? Well, I think that the answer lies in the distribution of human knowledge. There's an idea that came out in the 1980s and 90s called distributed cognition, but it's not that it was first practiced then. It's just the term. And you find in some historical studies, there's a beautiful book written about the Canal du Midi, literally the Canal of the South, a canal which crosses the southwestern corner of France. And it's a wonderful historical study showing how engineers at that time worked together with peasants, even local women who understood how water flows in those soils, even people who were trying, you know, thieves and bandits. Why thieves and bandits? Because they had to hide from the authorities. So they are the people that knew the landscape better than anybody else. the farmers who knew different kinds of soils, because when you're building a canal, you want soil that's resistant to water seeping through it. You know, I mean, you can line the canal to a certain extent, but, you know, if you build a canal on sand, it's always going to leak, no matter how much waterproofing you put in it. So you try and build the canals through soils that have a very high clay content. And who would know where the clay is? Well, the farmers. And it's a wonderful study showing what appeared to be technically impossible at the time, because certainly the scientific authorities and the leading academies didn't have the knowledge to build that canal. It was done by combining that formal knowledge with the enormous know-how that resided amongst the local population. And the person who put it all together was actually a tax collector. And why a tax collector? Because he knew everybody. He knew who was who.
he
knew how to influence everybody. So he had the skills to tie it all together. And that's the situation you find in engineering, that the young engineer comes in, doesn't know very much. You know, an engineer goes into a factory producing electric motors, has learned the fundamentals of electromagnetism, but has got no idea about, you know, commercial electric motors and how they're made. But there's lots of people, even people working on the production line, who've got knowledge that they need. So their ability to operate as engineers depends on them being able to get people with the right skills and knowledge to contribute that knowledge at the right time and then in the right way. It's a coordination exercise. And in one of my early papers in 2007, I explore that in some detail, this idea of technical coordination. You know, it takes about 30% of the time of engineers, but it is getting other people with special knowledge, skills, and expertise to do their bit, maybe by email, maybe face-to-face, whatever method is appropriate. And it's a largely informal process. You know, a lot of people say, oh, that's just project management, isn't it? Well, it's not, because nothing's ever written down. It's just, Bill, look, I need those results next Monday. Do you think you can do it for me? Oh, Jeff, yes. Yeah, sure. Look, I'm sorry, I forgot. I'll definitely do it, you know. And I'll see you at the barbecue on Sunday anyway, so I'll definitely make sure it's done by then. Otherwise, mate, I won't be at the barbecue. Right. I'll be doing it. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And there's a special language that engineers use to communicate, too. There was a book called Designing Engineers that was Louis Bucarelli, I think.
That's right, yes. It's a wonderful book.
And he talked about, in engineering meetings, the shortcuts that engineers would use. They would use just a single word or a phrase to represent an abstract idea. And that was enough to signal to the other engineers what needed to be done. And so even among engineers, there's sort of a special shortcut that I don't think normal communication classes would discuss or cover.
You know that there is a deeply embedded issue here. You're right. Engineers use a verbal shorthand. And often we assume that the other person is understanding what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so many engineers get into trouble because the other side doesn't actually understand, or even worse, understands something different.
Right.
I'll give you a couple of instances. One is in the paper, which you have read, about interactions with accountants. So many engineers we've met have been frustrated talking with accountants. And yet now, after having studied this issue, I asked these engineers, I said, do you understand what's meant by accrual accounting? And I've never yet met an engineer who can give me an explanation. And yet this concept is so fundamental in accounting that it's in the first few pages of an accounting textbook. It's like more basic even than stress and strain is for engineers. So my argument is simply this. If you can't speak the language of an accountant, well, of course you're going to have a frustrating time talking with them. So get to know the language. Just like if you want to take out you meet somebody to whom you suddenly feel romantically inclined in Paris, but they don't speak English, well, go and learn a bit of French and you'll have a wonderful time.
Right.
Now, you know, I'm not suggesting that engineers all study accountancy. It's not needed for that, but at least some indication that you've taken the trouble to understand the basics of the language establishes that trust and that willingness to work together, which is so important. But there's another issue that lies beyond that, and for this I'm indebted to a graduate student who started studying maintenance technicians and ended up taking me through a fascinating journey that involved the work of Wolfgang Goethe, the famous German philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
He anticipated Darwin by a century. He anticipated the French postmodernist philosophers by 200 years. But he put his finger on something really important, and that is that when we think about something, the ideas in our head that represent it shift and move. Now, our language is no more than a set of symbols for the notions that we have in our head. And when we use words, we are trusting that the person sitting next to us has the same notions. Well, of course, that's impossible. None of us can have an identical background. None of us have even an identical education. You think about all the experiences that you've had and how little of that is common to the person next to you, and you realize that the chances are that whatever words you use, they're going to connote different ideas in the head of somebody else. Now, in engineering, and it's both in practice and education, we have this amazingly naive idea that words are somehow standardized, that words mean the same things, that you can look up the definitions in a dictionary, and there's no need to explain what the words mean. There's no need to check that the other person has understood the words, because after all, well, everybody knows what, you know, what a bolt is, what a screw is, and so on. Whereas in actual fact, people in other disciplines have grown up to realize that you can't rely on that. And that's why so many engineers find themselves, I think, at a disadvantage in conversations with lawyers, business people, and so on. Now this idea that words mean different things to different people has become general knowledge thanks to postmodernism, something which many engineers frown on and say, oh, you know, postmodernism, rubbish. You know, it's regarded with disdain widely. But the idea behind it, which is that words are context dependent, that we really do need to understand what the other person is thinking about, is something that engineers have still to grasp. And it would make so much of their work easier. You know, I'll give you a very simple example. One of my graduate students is studying maintenance and studying the difficulties encountered by firms who install these large computerized maintenance management systems, CMMS, typically sold by companies like SAP. And she's described several instances where the maintenance and reliability engineers have been so disappointed with the results. And she talks about how the experts who come in and configure these systems sit down in meetings at the beginning of the project and say, sure, you know, our software can do this, it can do that, and so on and so forth. And then when they hand over the software, the maintenance engineers say, but it can't do what we want. You know, what are you talking about? You said it can do this, but actually it can't. Look, here, it won't do it. Mm-hmm. Now, the two words can do, what do they actually mean? Well, to the SAP specialist who comes in to configure the software, when he says SAP can do X, what it means is that SAP can do X provided I write the configuration code and charge you a fee for doing so.
It's not impossible.
I can make SAP do this report or provide this information for you, but they shorten that to say SAP can do X. And they assume that on the other side of the table, that a bunch of engineers who don't know much about software will say, well, if SAP can do X, that they understand that it requires to be configured. The engineers on the other side of the table, of course, understand can do to mean that the software can do it out of the box. It doesn't need to be configured because it can do it.
Right.
And so we see how such simple English words can so easily connote different meanings to different people over and over again.
Right.
So I think that's something which a lot of engineers could get a great deal of value from learning. And, you know, getting these ideas out in a way in which engineers relate to and engage with is really the challenge that we face. Now that we've identified these issues, the next challenge is to write it down in a way that engineers can understand it.
Well, I was going to ask about that because, you know, you mentioned with students that when they haven't been out in, you know, in a work situation, they haven't been working with practical engineers, you know, practicing engineers rather, they can't really grasp this stuff. They don't come back and say, oh, I really needed to know that until they experience it. Is it possible to say up front, you know, you're going to need this, or is that just kind of cast off and said, well, whatever?
Yeah, for some students, you know, we have a wonderful course here on social justice, which is taught as an elective. only a tiny handful of students are taking it at the moment, but the ones who do get enormous benefit out of it because they start to learn about some of these issues, and other students go off and do philosophy. Certainly at my university, we've realized that this necessity for engineers and others to study outside their home disciplines is incredibly important, and it's going to be so much more important in future. So we've just changed our entire course structures to make sure that this happens. At least it's possible for them to do it. Now, whether they actually are able to bring that knowledge into sway in their engineering work is another question. So for a long time in Australia, many of our leading universities have offered combined degree courses, and the most popular option for engineers is a combined degree with commerce. So in the paper, which I drew your attention to, we actually interviewed engineers, some of whom had studied commerce, and we found even then that their understandings of value were isolated from their engineering, the engineering part of their mind. They hadn't yet joined up ideas that they learned in finance with what they did in the engineering workplace. So just because students study it doesn't mean to say that they will access that knowledge and see its relevance when they start practicing as engineers. So we have to go further than just exposing these ideas in undergraduate studies. As you said, many students will reject it out of hand, so they won't learn it. You know, if there's an old saying, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And the same applies so much to students. But, you know,
teach a horse to email.
Okay, I didn't know this. I didn't know this stuff when I was a young engineer, and I've managed to learn it.
Right.
We can learn. That's the essence of being a human being. We can learn these ideas once we see that they're relevant. So the challenge is that of demonstrating its relevance.
Well, I recall that as well. I mean, I actually remember the situation of, you know, sitting in class and thinking, why am I learning this? Why am I learning this? And it was actually my co-op experience, or, you know, internship or whatever you wanted to call it, where I was out in the workforce for 7 months at a time actually working. That's when the actual context came in. What I mean, do you promote that kind of thing as well with like practical?
Of course we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and one of the studies that we conducted, albeit not in a terribly controlled manner, but other people have come up with similar findings. Yeah. Our first year students, our freshmen, as you would say in America, have a better idea of what engineers do and what's important to learn than students in their final year. They understand the importance of teamwork and communication skills. Mind you, they think they're very good at it, which is is wonderfully naive. But that doesn't matter. They realize it's important. By the time they get to final year, they don't even think it's important. Now, as I said to you, we have to respect the value of the knowledge that's already within engineering schools. And the worst possible thing we could do is get rid of that. We have to approach this in a very much more intelligent way and say, well, okay, many of these issues are best learned once there is real exposure to difficulties in the workplace, when students, well, young graduates, suddenly find that they can't achieve things because of factors related with finance, people, suppliers, and so on. That's the time to help them learn it. Now, I tried to do this myself. I worked with some young engineers in a consultancy firm on this issue of value. And it was like I'd hit my head against a brick wall. It was really, really difficult.
How so?
And I realized, well, I'll give you an example. About as far as we got was this idea that, well, my work creates value because somebody pays for it. It was very hard to get beyond that. Mm-hmm. And I realized that there wasn't the reading material for them to go away and study, even. There was nothing I could point them to that was relevant to their engineering practice, where they could understand the idea of commercial value in the context of engineering, and particularly the idea that value is so tied up with this issue of uncertainty. And so that was what I realized on reflection. And that's why since then, my main objective has been to write and to get other people working in the area to write stuff that engineers at that stage of their career can read with and engage and see the relevance of it. Once that material is there, then we can start to really do exciting things.
So is the idea of reducing uncertainty, is that the main value that engineers bring to the workplace?
Well, it's not the main value, but it certainly is terribly important. You know, one of the realities of engineering is it's expensive. You can't do much in engineering without spending a large amount of money. And it's much better if that money comes from somebody else rather than yourself.
Usually it is, yes.
So in order to do that, you have to realize that the people supplying the money really don't have very much idea about what it is you're doing. They trust you. They either trust you or your employer. They trust somebody to look after their money and to make sure it's going to produce results. So a lot depends on how they perceive the risks of doing that. You know, if you're a well-established firm and you've got a long history of producing results on time and within, you know, reasonable percentage of the original budget, people are prepared to spend a lot of money. That's why well-established firms tend to handle the big projects. It's because they are trusted. Small firms that don't have that reputation have to build up that reputation by working on small projects and gradually develop the trust that's needed with the investment community. Now, there's some useful analogies here. If you think about it, you know, we're all the same, more or less. Yeah, we're all prepared to invest somewhere of the order of $200,000 to maybe $1 million or more in a house, somewhere to live, because we generally think that that's a pretty safe investment. And yet, can I ask you, how much would you be prepared to bet on a horse race?
Much less.
Exactly. So what we're prepared, the amount of money we're prepared to put at risk depends on how we perceive the risks. If it's more risky, not only do we want to get a return quicker, like you'd be pretty angry if you went to a gambling casino and they told you you could collect your winnings in 12 months.
Right.
But you also, you don't put up so much money at risk. Now, let's take the example of an engineer that goes away and does a thorough safety analysis. So he checks a design works out in the end that having examined all the details of the components, how they're to be used, the suppliers and so on and so forth, that everything complies with the necessary safety requirements, that all the due processes are in place, that the necessary testing has been done and so on. Now, that engineer has not reduced the cost of what is to be produced. They haven't shortened the time scale. If anything, they've probably added time to the overall project. What value have they contributed? Now, for many engineers, that's a real struggle. You know, I was working in this consultancy firm with engineers who were doing studies on vibration on piping systems. And in the end, they said, look, it's just a tick-the-box exercise. The client wants it done. You know, what's the value of that? And that's a hard question to answer. But the answer lies in this idea of risk perception. That by reducing the perceived risk, because all this work has been done, investors are prepared to spend more. And that's why you see the typical structure of engineering projects these days, where the first stage is a feasibility study, which may cost a few $1,000s to a few tens of thousands, and that's followed by a more detailed study. And you sometimes go through a whole series of stages like that. Each time, the amount of money at risk is increased. Each time, the level of uncertainty is reduced until eventually you get to the final investment decision. That's when the big money has to be committed. So engineers spend a lot of their time essentially working to reduce the perception of risk. But the important idea is it's the perception of risk by the investor. It's not the actual risk. They're two very different things.
Interesting, because when I read through your paper and was thinking about the reducing uncertainty, I was thinking in terms also of the actual performance of the product or device or service.
Exactly, that's right.
That the other part the engineers bring is by doing a good job of design, they reduce the possibility it's going to fail once it gets into the consumer's hands. They've reduced the possibility that there's going to be some sort of accident, you know, because they've built a sturdy bridge, that kind of thing.
That's fine. You know, that's the way that we engineers look at it. But it's important to put yourself in the minds of the investor that's putting up maybe for a new product, it may be an investment of $20, $50 million.
Right.
And they're thinking about the possible litigation that might come 3 years down the line. You know, it might be a $100 million lawsuit because some damage has occurred to an environmentally sensitive national park or something like that. Right. Because people bought this product and it had certain chemical compound in it, and somebody left a few of them in some natural park and it killed some fish.
Right.
When they decomposed. Yeah, that's the kind of worry that investors bring to the table. And so it's very important for engineers to put themselves in the shoes of the investor. Martha Nussbaum, a wonderful American philosopher and author, expressed this so succinctly in some of her recent work, Educating for Liberty and Freedom. Mm-hmm. And the ideas that the basic idea that she was putting across is that so much of our education is now aimed at the economic, the technical, making products and profits, mm-hmm. And not for liberty. And I would argue that the very ideas that she is arguing are so important for liberty and human rights are equally important to get good value out of engineering. To be good engineers, we need to put ourselves in the minds of the investors and understand their perspective, because after all, it's their money we're playing with. We have a great time spending their money. So the least we can do is respect the point of view of the people who put up that money.
So when you speak of the investor, I think of investors like being venture capitalist type, but certainly it's a broader term than that. They're investors within the corporation. I mean, the people who are making the financial decisions for the company would be considered investors in this framework.
They may well be, because their future may depend on how we as engineers perform. But more likely, you've got to think of, is it pension funds that are putting up the money? Mm-hmm. Or is it a bunch of venture capitalists? Is it people who want a quick profit and a fast return on their investment? What are they after? Now, as engineers, sometimes you at the working level of the organization, it's quite hard to get access to them. You can't just simply ask your boss, say, who's the investor in this project? Because maybe the investors don't want to tell us who they are. But it's not difficult to think about how different kinds of investors might see what's going on. And what I argue, what I've argued is that there's a very useful theoretical framework to describe this. It's called value expectancy theory. Now, one of the aspects of engineering work is that we're largely autonomous. We decide which emails we open first in the morning. We look down the list and say, oh, I don't want to open that one. And so we enjoy the luxury of deciding what we do at any given stage of the day, except, of course, we think, oh, no, I've got to go to meeting X, meeting Y, and so on and so forth. We like to have a day that's completely free of meetings, so we're completely free to decide what we want to do. Well, psychologists have studied this, and what they tell us is that what we choose to do is mirrored intuitively by the value that we see coming from that. So we will choose to do things which we think create value. Now, as engineers, we can do well by being more aware of how value is created by our work. If we understand what's creating value for our organization, we're more likely to do things which will result in real value for our organization, our community. And this comes back to a wonderful comment that I heard from a very senior business executive, which again is in the paper, when he said, our engineers don't understand the business imperative of this organization. They simply don't get it, and it frustrates me immensely. Mm-hmm. And he's quite right. As engineers, we don't understand value. Very, very few of the engineers in our studies have any kind of understanding of commercial value. And so that's a big challenge for us as educators. We've got to bridge that gap somehow, and we can help to make engineers have a much more rewarding time, because if they're creating more value for their company, economic theory and practice will tell you that they'll earn more. And when surveys are done of engineers, there was a very extensive survey done by ASCE a few years back. Engineers were frustrated because they felt they were underpaid. And they weren't getting access to sufficient responsibility. They saw other people getting over them in the race for promotion. Well, yes. It's because those other people have a better understanding of value.
Interesting. What about like Daniel Pink's book about drive, and how he argues that the monetary compensation actually doesn't really, like increasing compensation doesn't really do it, but it is those other things you talked about with, autonomy and mastery and Oh, I always forget the last
yeah,
one.
Yeah, no, I haven't read that particular
purpose.
I haven't
you.
Read that particular book. I came across this again, thanks to my graduate students who brought me in touch with the work of George Akerlof, who's a former Nobel Prize winner in economics, and his colleague, I think Elizabeth Cranton, if I remember right. And they had proposed this idea of value economics, this idea that we know that monetary compensation doesn't motivate people. It has a short-term motivating effect.
Right.
But if people identify with the values of the organization they work for, then the results are going to be more productive.
Oh, okay.
And in essence, they've drawn attention to this same issue. Now, as engineers, we have the option to learn a little bit more and understand a little bit more about what we're doing. And so it's not just a question of trying to figure out whether our own values align with those of the organization, but also looking at it from a commercial value perspective and saying, well, actually, we could do a lot more for this organization if we understood what creates real value. And for some customers, it's finishing a job on time or a little bit early. For others, it's engineering something which is going to still operate in 30 years' time. For others, it's something which is delivered as quickly as possible and is going to make a profit in the first 12 months. And then afterwards, it doesn't matter. And it's understanding what the client actually wants. Now, the difficulty is, of course, that most clients, even if you have access to them, won't articulate those ideas directly. They won't tell you, this is my risk profile. You have to engage in a conversation to find that out. And again, this comes back to education. We don't encourage our students to engage others in conversation. I can remember when I graduated, I was incredibly shy. The last thing I wanted to do was to engage other people in conversations. I was much happier interacting with a computer. But if I'd known earlier how influential that could have been on my career, I would have been more receptive to it at the time. Right. I mean, life has a way of presenting you with challenges that force you out of your shell anyway. That happened to me a number of times.
Right.
So I'm grateful for all those learning experiences, which seemed pretty traumatic at the time.
Well, so if you're an engineer that is in their mid to late 20s, you're sort of out there in the world, and you say, well, I'd like to learn more about the values that our company's products provide. I'm just trying to think what advice we could give those people about who to talk to. I mean, do you go talk to the marketing people or the sales people trying to figure out what they think the value is to the customers, or do you try to get direct access to the clients to ask them about what they think?
My suggestion is make every effort you can to go and talk to the actual customers. And here again, you have to distinguish between customers who are paying for the work to be done and the end users, who may be a completely different group of people. And sometimes these different groups of people, all of whom in some ways are customers or end users, they all have different ideas about what they want. So there's no easy answers. But certainly taking the time and trouble to go out and talk to people can be immensely worthwhile. And you quite often learn things that you were never expecting to learn, which later turn out to be amazingly valuable. So that's my suggestion, is go out and talk to people and learn to listen. Learning to listen is perhaps the hardest part. There's a wonderful book called People Skills by Robert Bolton. It's quite an old book now. It is a very inexpensive book to buy, but the first chapter gives you comprehensive instruction on listening skills. And another bit of advice that I pass on to many of my students is to listen to radio programs where there's a transcript available. So listen to the podcast or radio show first, just maybe 5 or 10 minutes at a time. Don't be ambitious and try and listen to the whole thing. Make notes as you go, and then try and reconstruct everything that was said there. For goodness sake, don't press the pause button. That's the only thing you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to press pause. And then you go back to the transcript and compare what you had with what the transcript says and give yourself a percentage score. You know, did you get everything? Did you get the substance of everything that was said? If so, give yourself hearty congratulations. You know, when I started, I was at a very low percentage, but gradually I gradually improved. So I find that most people require that kind of practice over 2 or 3 weeks, and then their listening skills are greatly improved. That's the best advice I can give you today.
Terrific. Um, In the paper that you had us read, one of the things I found interesting was your description of what factors made engineers more effective in different parts of the world. And in particular, you were talking about having a good line of communication and not having social norms block those communications, and engineers having a certain amount of autonomy made the engineers more effective regardless of what their academic training had been.
On the basis of the very limited evidence that we have been able to collect so far, I would say, yes, that's more or less what we found. But, you know, it's we're at such a preliminary stage and so few people have looked at this mm-hmm. that it's a field that's wide open for other researchers to come in and investigate. But to me, I look around when I go to developing countries. I spend a lot of time in Pakistan, a little less time in India. But I have been to many developing countries in my career. Mm-hmm. What I have noticed is that the cost, the real cost of engineered services that we all take for granted here in Australia, America, the industrialized world, those real costs are so much higher. And they're higher because you have to take into account the value of unpaid time and trouble. Time spent in queues, time spent in traffic congestion, time spent carrying water. And even though the value is very small in the local context, and you can look up this value of time in standard economic text, by the way, it's nothing new. We use it to make decisions about whether or not to build highways and bridges. It's exactly the same idea. It's related to the rate at which, in fact, the best indicator is I believe, around about 60% of what women would earn in the area doing basic work like cleaning and so on. Now, that value of time is really important because it gives you this economic perspective. So we go to countries like you might go to some of the countries in the Caribbean, Haiti and so on, and say, well, it's very cheap to live there because everything is so inexpensive. You can hire a driver for almost nothing. When you actually live there, you suddenly find how expensive everything is. Even safe drinking water can be many times the cost per ton that you would get it at home. Energy is much more expensive because more often than not, you need a generator. The energy supply is intermittent, so you need all kinds of, you have to take all kinds of precautions if you want continuous energy, particularly if you're going to run a factory or something like that. And these costs mount up. So what we think of as low-cost countries are, in fact, high-cost countries. Now, the really interesting thing is that the engineers working in those environments don't realize this. And so they seem to make decisions which actually make the situation worse. So, for example, in India, what we found is that engineers will say, well, labor is very cheap here, so I can, you know, it's very difficult for me to justify investment in machinery because labor is so cheap. Well, that's taking the face value of the labor cost, so many dollars per hour. But then you've got to think about what's the cost of supervising that labor? Because certainly in South Asia, nothing happens without supervision. Work stops. People don't just get on with it. As soon as the supervisor's not there, the work stops entirely. And because of the very low investment in education, engineers on production lines in India spend an awful lot of their time working face-to-face with production workers, showing them how to do their job. And that's very expensive because not only the production rate's low, but also you're tying up engineers who could be doing much more valuable things. So
the attrition there is usually pretty poor as well. I mean, from what I've learned.
Well, that's a labor regulation issue.
Right.
So you realize that ultimately they're reliant on the same machinery that we use in our factories. You know, when it comes to machining and all these engineering jobs, you're using capital equipment. The value of the land is very high. So real productivity depends on how effectively you use machinery. It has nothing to do with labor cost. But because the labor appears to be cheap, that issue is relegated to secondary status, and so you find utilization rates are very low because very often the standard of maintenance is poor, so the machinery breaks down far more often than it should. And then you realize that's why things are expensive.
Right.
But you have to step back from it, and it's very hard for engineers to do that given the kind of background that's available at the moment. So again, that's why I have to write up a lot of this work so that we can help engineers make much better decisions.
Right, right. I found it interesting that you talked about how some of the social norms caused a blockage or a limitation in the communication, especially through the hierarchy of a bureaucracy or in an organization.
You're right, and that's very important. That the issue is not how we improve communication. You know, you can't change social norms.
Right.
Certainly not in the timescale available to engineers. So you have to figure out how to work around it. And, you know, my greatest inspiration showing that great engineering can be done in these environments is the mobile phone. Mobile phone systems have been extraordinarily successful right across the developing world. They're so successful that in many countries, mobile phones are used as the informal banking system. You put credit on my phone instead of paying me cash, and you can do that electronically over a great distance. So the question we have to ask is, why has it been so successful when water and energy utilities and manufacturing, by and large, fail so abysmally? Mm-hmm. Now, there are many interesting answers there. We haven't got time to go into them today, but I hold that up to my students as a case study. Yes, engineering can work in these environments because it, more or less by accident, has overcome these difficulties. And so it just shows that engineering can work everywhere, but we have to take the social context into account.
Right. It sort of goes back to, you talked about that something like 60% of an engineer's job was communicating with others.
I don't like that word communicating. I actually much prefer the term collaborating.
Okay.
All right. 100% of an engineer's job is collaborating with other people. And communication is a necessary part. You can't collaborate with other people without communication. So let's see communication as the means by which we collaborate.
Okay.
And let's look at different ways we collaborate rather than trying to focus on separate communication skills, which in isolation, it's quite hard to see how they're used until you understand the ways that we collaborate. Right. So the most complex collaboration that is routinely practiced is technical coordination, where you have to get the willing and conscientious collaboration of somebody else to do something in a particular time frame. That's what engineers spend a great deal of their time doing. But let's see it as that rather than trying to improve your communication skills because of the way that term can be misunderstood. If we look at how communication skills are taught in the academy, it's writing technical reports and preparing PowerPoint presentations. So communication is very often seen as an information transfer process from me, the engineer, to the client. And that's a very simplistic idea of communication. Real communication is collaboration, and that first of all means two-way communication. And secondly, other factors become very important, like relationships, a respect, creating appropriate perceptions of what we're doing as individuals and what we're trying to achieve so that we get this alignment of values.
We talked earlier about other programs that you know, engineers might step into to try and learn some of these skills, but do you see other programs that do teach these kind of things? I mean, are these skills that can be taught in a university setting in the first place?
Definitely they can be taught in a university setting. There's no question about that. The difficulties that we face is that, you're right, at the moment, there is nowhere really for engineers to go. Obviously, you can learn a lot in a business school, but the difficulty with the research that underpins teaching in business schools is that it's aimed at this hypothetical person that we call a manager. And particularly in America, managers are seen as a distinctly separate species from engineers. So the moment you go to management school, you're setting yourself up to be a manager and you're no longer an engineer.
Right.
And the reality is that most of what we're encountering and uncovering in our research is not taught in management schools. Yes, some of the basics are. You can learn about organizations. You can learn about value economics. You can learn about finance. You can learn about accounting. It's all useful stuff. I wouldn't stop anybody who wants to from going away to study that. But it's only the beginning. It's foundation material.
Right. My friends who are – my one friend who's in MBA school right now, she says it's all in the connections. It's all – half the learning is done at the bar after work. You know, at the pub, you know, that's when the relationships are formed, and that's when you're really working with people on projects or talking about, you know, what's really happening at school.
Well, that's I've heard that comment many times, and it's quite correct. Of course, if you study the way students learn in higher education, they do learn far more from each other than they learn from directly from the teacher, the lecturer, whoever you like to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the lecturer or the professor is there as a facilitator more than anything else to inspire students to learn, to inspire students to do the hard work. Yes, in business school you do these projects, but you do them because you feel inspired to do it, and people put in real effort because they feel that they're getting somewhere. So that's an important part of education. However, it as I said, it's just the beginning. And, you know, the person you're talking about probably did the same thing in her undergraduate studies, but wasn't quite so aware that that's what they were doing. That's why, you know, a big emphasis in the work now is on getting together, putting all this material together in a coherent way so that in future people can understand it. And I hope that lots of others will go out and study more engineers in practice. It's been interesting for me to try and understand the apparent reluctance I see among my colleagues to go and do that. And I'm not sure I have all the answers yet on that one.
Was there value in just, you know, I agree that studying this is important, and it's quite interesting actually, but is a possible solution just to throw everyone in the blender and, you know, all right, everyone does internships, everyone does apprenticeships. Is that a solution, or is that just kind of band-aiding the problem?
You know, a century ago, that's how engineers learned their skills. And we've moved on from there. How many engineers would accept the idea that, well, you can pick up stress analysis just by learning it on the job? Well, if you look back at in the 1960s, when engineering curricula more or less solidified in the form that we find them today, the knowledge that you could rely on, the academic knowledge that you could rely on to work in practice, was limited to the physical sciences and underpinned by mathematics. But you know, we've moved on. We now have a much greater reservoir of knowledge and understanding that's emerged in the humanities, social sciences, even in business, that today can be applied nowhere more relevant than perhaps in education faculties. You know, until the 1990s, studies of learning were largely restricted to contrived situations in psychology laboratories, where mainly undergraduate students who, because they were the easiest recruits, went inside and pressed buttons when things flashed across screens, and that's how we studied human learning. And then in the 1990s, Anne Brown and many others started to study what happened in real classrooms. And we're now seeing the results of that flowing into our schools. Now we know that there are much more effective education techniques that are now ready to be applied. We can train teachers to use them, and the results are astonishing. But that knowledge emerged in the 1990s. And that knowledge could be incredibly useful for engineers who find the issue of trying to get other people to understand what they're on about so frustratingly difficult. Well, learning about education, learning how people learn, can be tremendously helpful. So a lot of the knowledge that we need has only become available in the last few decades. So perhaps we now need to go back and rebuild what we see as being the intellectual foundations of engineering practice. And that's what I'm on about. Once we've got that structure in place, then that knowledge is much more accessible for the people who need it. You know, we learn engineering because it's there in the textbooks, and you can study them. You can pull them off your bookshelf if you've forgotten how to do Moore's circle. You can pull it off your bookshelf, and there it is in an engineering handbook. Well, a lot of this stuff is not yet in engineering handbooks. It needs to be there before we can really make progress.
Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing more about it and reading more about it, because some of it's, I mean, as much as, you know, I've only been in the workforce for 5 or 6 years now, or 7 years, I don't even remember, but it continues to boggle my mind. The human interactions, the, you know, just the, everything you've described, it is an ongoing challenge. I think even people that have been in the industry 40, 50 years would agree with that, you know, that is one of the toughest parts.
Exactly. And, you know, a century ago, engineers would have said the same about stresses in pipes and boilers. And we look back and see how heavily constructed all those machines were, because we didn't really understand stress analysis in a way that could be done quickly and easily. Today, we can do that. So I'm sure that in 100 years' time, we will look back on today and say, gee, those engineers were primitive. They really didn't know how to handle people, but we can do it so much better today. I look forward to that. And I also look forward to, you know, ending poverty, because to me, so much poverty that we see around us is caused by the lack of the effective practice of engineering. And that's something we can do about. We can do something about that, and we can do it relatively quickly once we figure out what needs to be done.
Well, that's great. James, thank you for being on the show today. It's been very enlightening.
It's been wonderful. Yeah.
Well, thank you. You know, every time I talk about this, new ideas come into my head. So now I've got to go and write a few notes about some of the things I said, and I shall be referring to your recording, which I'm sure will be very high quality, and that'll be a wonderful resource for my research. And, you know, I encourage you to keep on thinking. You know, even your listeners, keep on thinking, and if they come up with ideas and suggestions, they're welcome at any time to write. I'm sure that you'll have a webpage reference on your website, and that'll give them my coordinates, and
okay. Be
quite happy. But I'm sure you must remind them that we academics do go into retreat every now and again to write, and right. So sometimes it takes a while to respond. We're not online 24 hours a day.
Well, thank you so very much for taking time to talk with us about some various aspects of engineering. It's been a terrific discussion.
I agree.
All right. Well, Chris and Jeff, thank you very much. All the very best.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision, in association with Engineering.com. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.